Chapter 8. Unavoidable Consequences. The next morning, I head for the office early. Still yawning. I was up past midnight being checked out by paramedics, then filling out incident reports. Then pull my emergency meeting suit out of its carrier and head round to the new annex. I've been summoned by the auditors. Happy joy. It's not just the SE. In his capacity as chair of the incorrigible committee, but the auditors as a committee, sitting en banc. The report on Agent Candid's encounter with Stripjack Sprat has collided with a copy of the fatal accident report that is climbing its way up the Independent Police Complaints Commission's entry and butted heads with yesterday's fracas at the library. We still don't have a complete list of what went stolen or missing in the raid. Freudstein's people made a comprehensive mess out of the main display in the atrium and did a real number on several archives, and were working over the rare music manuscripts when I interrupted them. But the auditors want to hear from me in person, even in the absence of a full report. This is quite worrying, because it suggests the organisation as a whole may be going into damage control mode. They've cleared one of the larger offices on the top floor, one of the mahogany row offices, and rolled out the resonant carpet. I wait in the receptionist's office until I'm summoned, trying not to succumb to anticipatory collywobbles. I've been so busy lately that this almost seemed like a trivial irritation at first, certainly after being carpeted by the Cobra subcommittee and then the Home Secretary. I'm becoming inured to high-level grilling. But you can't ignore the auditors. They are the front line of our operational oversight system. If you run an organisation that gives people like me extraordinary, and lethal, occult powers, you need investigators with similar skills to keep them on the straight and narrow, and their powers to compel and control are themselves extraordinary, and potentially lethal.
Dr. O'Brien, if you'd please come in.
The secretary to the audit committee sticks her head round the door and gives me a sympathetic smile. I stand up and enter. There are five of them, sitting behind a table with seating for six. The empty chair is telling. Judith, I think with a pang.
Good morning, says Dr. Armstrong.
His colleagues nod affably. Hello, I say, somewhat nervously.
If you'd like to take a seat,
ask the man to the SA's right. His accent has a faintly musical lilt, not one I recognise. He's a distinguished-looking fellow in late middle age, possibly with Jamaican ancestry. His beard is bushy and mostly white. There's a wooden chair in the middle of the grid woven into the carpet. Thanks. I walk across to it and sit down. My buttocks tense, as if I'm taking a seat in Old Sparky.
Let's keep this simple, shall we?
Ask the woman sitting to the left of Judith's empty chair. Middle-aged, mousy and inoffensive. She's probably capable of zapping me into a pile of smouldering cinders if she takes a dislike to me.
Dr. O'Brien.
She looks at me, and as I meet her gaze and fall into her infinitely dark pupils, I lose contact with my body.
Did you deliberately kill Stripjack Sprat, also known as Dougal Slaithwaite, in the cells under Belgravia Police Station last Thursday?
No.
My tongue is chokingly large and made of dry leather, dusty as the tomb. I can no more stop it wagging than I can stop my heart beating. I was unaware of the significance of his medical condition until it was too late. My interrogator nods. The SA looks relaxed as he asks the next question.
Do you believe he was working for Professor Freudstein?
That seems probable, although I believe Mr. Slaithwaite might not have fully understood what he was doing. The auditors glance at each other.
Told you so.
murmurs the man on the SA's right. More questions follow, as they piece together a detailed timeline of the events in Trafalgar Square. Then, probe my awareness of the unpleasantness at the Bank of England, and finally, walk me through my recollection of yesterday's events at the British Library. Then,
"Do you have any other suspicions?"
asks Dr. Armstrong.
Maybe.
My traitor tongue is hesitant? In front of the auditors? I nearly go cross-eyed in disbelief, despite the powerful gesh that alienates me from control of my own body.
"What do you mean, maybe?"
The woman sitting at the far right end of the table leans forward intently. She's nearly as striking as Mary, but entirely human. She has long black hair, and is somewhat Middle Eastern-looking, seemingly younger than I am, although you can never be certain among the DSSs of Mahogany Row.
"What do you..."
"Wait, Seth," says the other woman. "Let her..."
I somehow manage to lick my dry lips. "I'm not sure, and I don't want to prejudice your investigations. Suspicions not related to the killing, no obvious causal chain, but there's something odd about the staff assignments to the Transhuman Policy Coordination Unit. Something smells funny." Dr. Armstrong smiles.
"Good," he says. "If you'll excuse me."
He turns to his colleagues.
"We have addressed the core concern, have we not? If you don't mind, I would like to discuss Dr. O'Brien's other concerns with her under her own volition, rather than under compulsion in my capacity as operational oversight supervisor for the incorrigible committee."
"Why don't you want us to..."
Seth seems to want to grill me further, but the SA won't let her. He turns positively waspish, in fact.
"You know perfectly well that once you start digging for information under compulsion, trying to find evidence to support a hypothesis, you will find it every time. Even if it's the wrong hypothesis in the first place. I would prefer to rely on Dr. O'Brien's freely given cooperation."
His smile vanishes.
"Why don't you, Persephone? Don't you trust her?"
She crosses her arms.
"Very well. Have it your own way."
She's obviously annoyed with him about something, but I have no idea what, and it's perilously far above my pay grade to speculate. Chalk it up to hitherto unexplained politics among the auditors, throw salt over your shoulder, and move on.
"End testimony,"
incants the mousy-looking woman, directly to me.
"You may leave the grid now, Dr. O'Brien."
I feel as if invisible fetters have just evaporated from my hands and feet. I take a deep breath as I stand up.
"Thank you."
"Don't thank us,"
she nods affably.
"Your oath of office simply verified that you cleared yourself."
The SA stands up and walks across the room. He holds the door open for me. I emerge blinking into the daylight, feeling shaky and a little numb. More formerly solid pieces of my life are crumbling into fragments. Everything is spinning out of control. It's not a sensation I am remotely at ease with. After my session with the audit committee, I take a long lunch break while I pull myself together, then head over to a police station to give a statement about last night's excitement, then back to the office to chip away at the paperwork mountain. And I'm still there at 7 o'clock in the evening when my desk phone rings.
"You've got to come home," says Bob.
"Spooky needs you."
But I don't need Spooky. It's 7 o'clock, and everyone but me and Mary have gone home. I told them all not to bother coming in before noon tomorrow unless they feel like it. They're still catching their breath from the weekend madness, and I'm playing catch-up from the weekend, the Home Office grilling, and an exciting visit to the library. It feels as if I'm drowning in work, but it can't wait. Right now, I'm paging through a list of rare music manuscripts that are missing from a certain archive, trying to figure out if there's anything here that might give us a handle on Freudstein's goals or interests. Bob sounds distressed.
They're sending me away tomorrow.
What?
Does not compute.
Suddenly I find myself paying complete attention to the phone call. What do you mean?
I have to go up to Dunwich.
Angleton ran a lab there for dangerous experiments of some kind, and they need me to defuse the defensive wards. It might be an overnight trip, but having seen what he did to his office, it could easily take me the rest of the week.
Work can wait.
Where are you now? I ask.
In the kitchen.
Oh, damn. This long-distance telephone tag is no good, I tell him. I hit save on the laptop, leaving the list of stolen manuscripts for later. Judging by what his minions took, Freudstein must really like obscure 19th-century violin pieces. How about I come round? Do you want to call for a carry-out? Hope begins to rise. I know you're scared of the violin, but I figured out a way to secure it overnight.
Let's do that, he says after a pause.
Make a formal date of it.
A date? In my own home with my own husband? How strange.
Something about his offer makes me shiver, but in a nice way.
Yes, let's do that.
Love you, he says as if he needs reassurance.
Love you too, dear. I'll be about an hour.
It takes me 10 minutes to prepare my suitcase, grab my violin, and lock up the office. Mary looks up as I pass her open door.
What's up?
She asks. I show her some teeth.
I've got a home to go to. See you tomorrow.
She wrinkles her nose.
Don't you want to see the list of what Freudstein grabbed?
She looks affronted.
I pulled in favours to get this report, Mo.
Oh. Wait. Is that the same list I got 3 hours ago? Because if... Nope. She turns her laptop so that the screen points my way.
This is what Officer Friendly sent round 15 minutes ago. They eliminated duplicates and struck off a lot of items that got thrown on the floor when Freudstein went through. And we're down to about 50 possible primary targets and maybe 200 other items. But...
She flashes me a feral grin.
I asked the archivists at Danzy House to cross-reference them against our classification index.
Oh. Good thinking, I admit. I lean Lecter's case in the doorway and cross over to her desk. She can probably hear my heart thumping involuntarily, but she gives no sign of it as she pointedly turns back to her computer.
Did they find anything?
Not much, she admits. But there's a lot of weird-ass shit. That's their term, by the way, not mine. In the BL stacks. And some of it is possibly interesting. Did you know they had the score to a rock opera composed by Charles Manson on file?
Her brow wrinkles.
It's a bit shit, she admits. But that's not all. A whole bunch of esotericists dabbled in musicology over the past couple of centuries. Freudstein stole an organ piece by Aleister Crowley to be performed in Coventry Cathedral, the old one before it got bombed during the war, during a thunderstorm to summon the great salamander of galvanism, whatever that means. Bloody show-off. Then there's Delia Derbyshire's symphony for fixed disk storage systems that requires about £2 million worth of 1970 vintage IBM 370 series mainframe. Apparently if you move the disk drive, read-write heads fast enough, they make screeching sounds at set frequencies. And there was an operetta of The King in Yellow, scored as a violin concerto. It's all rare stuff, but it's hard to put a cash value on it. It's not like the Bank of England heist. Maybe Freudstein's trying to steal the soundtrack to a low-budget horror movie.
I sigh. What kind of sense do any of Freudstein's activities make? We've got a no-shit mad scientist on our hands and no idea what on earth he's trying to achieve. In terms of profiling him or her, we're a complete bust right now.
You done good, I assure her. But I really have to be going. Domestic emergency. Bob wants the cat tree cleaned. Can you email it to me for tomorrow? I mean, unless there's something so time-critical that it really can't wait for morning.
Sure.
She sounds slightly disappointed.
No, nothing that can't wait. Probably.
She pushes her own chair back.
I could be going too,
she says quietly, as if trying to convince herself. Knowing we've at least got a handle on the extent of the robbery salves the pain very slightly, which I need because the long hours have finally gotten to me. The adrenaline surge from my grilling by the auditors has long since worn off, and I feel, not to put it too crudely, like a used dish rag. I catch a bus most of the way home, then walk the last half kilometre. The suitcase seems to gain an extra kilo with every step. By the time I get to the front door, I'm almost staggering. So I lean close enough to push the doorbell with my nose and wait. Seconds pass. Then the door suddenly opens and I fall into the welcome arms of my husband. Mo. I drop my suitcase. Ouch! It lands on his foot. Sorry. I murmur in his ear. I have a double armful of husband. World's best teddy bear / security blanket. Combining intimacy and sex. What was I thinking, letting go of him? Oh, right. The violin case I'm holding behind his back suddenly weighs a ton. I reluctantly relax my grip on him.
Let me in. I've got stuff to put down.
Food can be ready whenever you want, he says, taking a step back. He looks me up and down with evident concern. Whether for my well-being or because he's worried I'm about to explode isn't immediately obvious.
Come in, Mo. Make yourself...
A sad little chuckle.
At home.
I step across the threshold, shove the door closed and look at him. Same old Bob. Maybe beginning to go a little thin on top. Are those new worry lines etched around his eyes? He's wearing the Hugo Boss suit I made him buy for meetings, albeit tieless, which is ultra-formal in Bob terms. I am acutely aware that I look like I've been dragged through a hedge backwards. Will dinner keep? Because I want to hit the bathroom first. I've been living out of a suitcase for days.
That makes two of us, he says. Don't worry about the food. I can heat it up.
Now he looks obscurely disappointed. You look great. Which is a little white lie. Bob never looks unreservedly great unless I put some effort into his turnout. But I want to build bridges, not burn them. And he seems to want to make an effort. The past week has been the cinematic trailer for Divorce, the high-budget remake. And it's not a movie I plan on buying a ticket to. I don't even want it on cut-price DVD, thanks. I put the violin case down, then close in on my man for a hug and a kiss. I was hoping for something more than a peck on his sandpaper cheek. Disappointment stabs briefly. Sore at me?
A little, he admits.
I make a second attempt, and we smooch like awkward teenagers for a few seconds. Not only is it unsatisfying, one or both of us has morning breath. I pull back. I really need the bathroom, I say. Freshen up in a quick change. Then I've got a surprise for you, if you're still serious about us dating. Half an hour? He thinks for a moment, then nods.
I'll feed Spooky and lay the table. She likes to sleep on a full stomach.
He looks at me, and I shiver pleasantly and raise an eyebrow, and he twitches back, and suddenly I know we're on converging courses again. We've been together long enough that we can read each other's signals. Deferred gratification, I warn him, then grab my suitcase and violin
and flee upstairs. How do you prepare for a date when you're worried you've irreparably damaged your marriage? I shove my violin case in the wardrobe again, lock it, and check the ward I put there last week is still working. Then, I make sure the damn cat isn't hiding in the bedroom, strip off and head for the shower. It's not actually as good as the one at the office. We have no booster pump at home, just traditional British plumbing that predates the last ice age. But it's mine. In my own home. That makes up for all defects. Also, I've got a shower cap, which shaves half an hour off the process. I raid the bedroom closet for my special underwear, then slither into the other dress I bought for the diplomatic junket and didn't get to wear. It's not so much cocktail hour as black tie. A black silk number that I knew at the time was a bit too daring, but couldn't resist. Floor-length skirt slit as high as my stocking tops. Lace bodice with short sleeves. At the back of the shoe rail, I have a pair of 5-inch heels I shouldn't have bought in the first place. So high I can't descend a staircase in them without a handrail. Then I add lipstick and eyeliner. This is silly, I think. It's bedroom cosplay. I wouldn't dare wear this combination in public. But in my own house, with my own husband, who isn't terribly good at doing subtle. How's the food, dear? I call down the stairs. Are you hungry? He replies from below. In the living room, I think. Because I can have it ready in 15 minutes. He'd better not. I have other plans. I'll be right with you. I manage to descend the stairs safely, then mince into the living room and strike a pose. Bob is sitting on the sofa with a half-empty glass of red wine in one hand, reading something on his tablet and looking morose. I notice he's actually wearing a tie, a piece of fabric to which he's just about allergic. For Bob, this is more than smart. He's making a weddings and funeral grade effort. I'm touched. The moment lasts almost a second, then he notices me. He drops the tablet and puts the wine glass down and stands up hastily, looking dazzled. Do you like this? I ask. He licks his lips. Wow. You said you wanted a date. I didn't think you meant a night at the opera. I didn't. His pupils dilate. I look into his eyes and see my own need mirrored there. I step close to him and take hold of the end of his tie. I tug, gently. Come here, husband. He makes an unfamiliar growling noise and zombie shuffles closer. Then remembers to wrap his arms around me and pull me close. My bedroom-only heels are so high that I'm actually looking down into his upturned, wondering face. My great big teddy bear doesn't do subtle. You have to tell him what you need very clearly. It's not the opera, dear. I just want you to fuck my brains out. God, I've missed that side of things. What? Right now? I silence him with a kiss and reach for his fly. His brain might be stuck at deer in the headlights, but below the belt, he's getting the message. He kisses me back with increasing urgency, finally realizing that I'm serious and he's not hallucinating. I crouch down and open his fly and lick, then suck, until the taste of his skin fills my mouth and I can feel his fingers tangling in my hair and he begins to make a noise like a stovetop kettle's whistle. Oh, God, Mo, he moans, and I shiver. I give him a last kiss and stand up. Do me, I tell him, right now. He picks me up and carries me to the over-padded sofa where he lays me down, carefully parts my legs with his hands and sets fire to me with his tongue. I close my eyes and fantasize my faceless dream lover in his place, and I begin to shudder. Then, when he's sure I'm as desperate as he is, he climbs on top of me and we mate like frenzied 40-year-old mammals who know it might be their last time ever. We make it to the kitchen eventually. In my case, by way of a diversion to the bathroom to undo some of the worst of the damage. I confront myself in the mirror. My hair is back to being a nest fit for crows. My lipstick and eyeliner are smeared. One lace stocking is slightly laddered. I left my shoes and best knickers on the living room carpet. And my fortune cookie says there will be a big dry cleaning bill in my future. So why is my reflection glowing? Sounds carry much too well in this house. And I can hear Bob whistling as he putters about the kitchen. I ache pleasantly. And I'm hungry. And he's about to feed me. Life is suddenly more than good. It's wonderful. I fix what I can fix, bounce downstairs, and ease my feet back into my bedroom shoes because I want to serve notice on Bob that we aren't done yet. Then I tiptoe through into the kitchen, where pleasant smells are wafting from the fan-assisted oven. "Nearly ready," he says cheerfully, pulling back one of the kitchen chairs for me. He has actually unearthed the linen tablecloth, a wedding present that sees the light of day less than once a year. There are lit candles and a bottle of overpriced Pinot Noir, and he's laid out the silver-plated cutlery set my grandmother left me.
"Cheers."
"To us," I say, raising my wine glass. His is nearly empty. I can see I have some catching up to do. "To that," he echoes as the kitchen timer goes off. Then he hurries to unload the oven. The food is nothing special, but it's after 10 o'clock and I've worked up an appetite. And Bob knows how to spice up a Chinese takeaway enough to bring it up to overworked, busy restaurant standard. I force myself to leave a third of my food unfinished. Bob is still eating, so I stretch my leg out and play footsie with the inside of his calf. I'm still extremely hungry, but not for food. "Bob," I begin to say. He sighs.
"We can't both stay the night."
"What?"
"I do not need this right now. There's..."
He puts his chopsticks down and swallows.
"Still the problem."
He is crestfallen. "Oh, that. What if I've got a solution?" That gets his immediate attention.
"What kind of solution?"
I tell him about the ward on the wardrobe and the key. "Here it is." I slide it across the top of the table. "Put it somewhere safe and don't tell me where. That way I can't accidentally get my hands on the violin in my sleep. If there's an emergency and you can't retrieve the key, there's always the crowbar under the bed."
"Which will..."
He looks at me so hopefully it's almost heartbreaking.
"You're sure you can live with being parted from it that way?"
"Proximity works. I don't need to hold him... it... the whole time." I shake my head. "He just has to be within reach. The wardrobe by the bed will do, and you've got the key." He looks at me, still concerned.
"You tried this?"
"Yes, and it was still in the wardrobe the next morning." He licks his lips nervously as I force myself to wait patiently for him to see sense. "Sex or safety? Which will win?" His face relaxes slightly, cheeks drooping just a bit.
"You want us both to stay the night?"
"When did we last have sex like that?" I ask rhetorically. We share a knowing glance.
"Yup, sex is winning.
We're at or past the 10-year mark. Things have calmed down to a weekly tempo, subject to work-related travel and other irritations. But
But things haven't been going so well since the Iran business. And then we just had a week of enforced separation. What we just did in the living room is unprecedented in recent years. It's why I married him in the first place. And just sharing that sly look of complicity with him has set me tingling again. Have you eaten enough? He looks at his bowl. Then he looks at me. His smile is luminous.
Food can wait. I suppose you want the main course now.
I ease my chair back and stand, then tiptoe around the table towards him. He meets me halfway.
In the bedroom this time,
I murmur into his ear. Nice and slowly. It's not as if one of us has to rush for the last tube. We go upstairs after dinner, and this time, we take the time to undress one another. At least, he wants me to undress him. He likes me to keep some of my underwear on. We make love until we're both sore and exhausted, and it's more painful than ecstatic, and then I make him fuck me a little more because I have an aching bob-shaped emptiness that I want to fill. He falls asleep, sprawled half on top of me, an hour after midnight, slowly withdrawing. World's biggest teddy bear. A comforting weight. Almost suffocatingly heavy. I shift around until I can breathe comfortably. Then spend so long thinking wistful, middle-aged thoughts about the bathroom that I, too, fall asleep. Unfortunately, my sleep is not dreamless. I'm on the black and white dance floor again, whirling in the arms of my faceless white-clad partner. Early 20th century ballroom. Not Viennese opera or new romantic gothic clubland. This time, wearing a long white debutante gown and flat pumps.
You disappoint me,
he says, in my father's borrowed tones.
I thought you were daddy's girl.
I realize that I got the scene wrong. It's not early 20th century ballroom, but early 21st century promise keepers, father and daughter religious freaks dancing to century-old melodies. Outrage and anger squeeze eschatology from my lips. Fuck this shit! I scream, words I don't use much in waking life. I try to stop and stand my ground, but he won't let me. I stumble, and he whirls me onwards on resisting feet. My father never abused me, you're lying. Stop trying to gaslight me. You're pushing a button that doesn't exist. My partner chuckles, then answers. Not in Daddy's long-dead voice, for which I am grateful.
Of course not. You can't blame me for trying, though, can you? It only works around 10% of the time, but when it works, it's very effective.
He lifts me bodily from the floor and swings me around him, forcing me to cling to his arms for dear life.
But if you won't cooperate of your free will, I'm afraid I'll have to compel you.
Wait, what? And I'm somewhere else, but still trapped in the claustrophobic dream, still spotlit but now seated, in an orchestra pit, wearing concert black with Lecter at my shoulder and his bow between my fingers. There is a music stand with a score positioned just where it belongs. The other violinists of the ensemble sit motionless to my right and left. I'm afraid to glance sideways. There's something uncannily gaunt about them as they wait, utterly still, like a bone sculpture garden at midnight. I sight-read the visible pages of the piece, feeling increasingly doubtful as I go along. It's an operatic composition, with a vaguely familiar name. The King in Yellow. Wait, isn't this one of the stolen manuscripts that Mary cross-checked in the laundry archive index? It seems to be a solo piece
for first violin from Act 1, Scene 2, Casilda's Song. It's a pleasant, if somewhat naively conventional melody, although the lyrics for the soprano who I'm to accompany fill me with a vague sense of dread.
"Play me,"
argues the thing in my hands. White and polished bone, and simultaneously bloated and visceral, and filled with rotting blood.
"It is the price you must pay."
"No," I try to say, the skin-crawling sense of wrongness intensifying as the bow tries to drag itself across the strings, my fingers enthrall to it. "No!" I am choking. I can't breathe. I try to stand up or to move, but I'm being held down by something, and it's so heavy, and I can't breathe, and when I try to inhale, there's a hideous charnel house smell, and something sharp stabs at my forehead. And I'm awake in bed with Bob sprawled across me. And the fucking cat is standing on my forehead with her claws out, hissing like a tea kettle that's about to explode. I manage to vent a shuddering, wordless cry of unease and aversion. Whoa! Spooky stops hissing, hunkers down, and leaps, using my head as an extremely painful springboard, right onto the small of Bob's back, nearly driving the wind out of both of us. Bob raises his head, and phosphorescent green pinworms coil and whirl behind his eyelids. Blink. I'm crouched on the landing at the top of the staircase, naked, except for one wrinkled and laddered stocking, and a couple of bruises that will be impressive by morning. I'm pulling the bedroom door closed, and I've got a crowbar in my hand, and the thing in Bob's body is slowly sitting up in the middle of the bed, raising zombie hands towards its face. A black furry shadow zips through the narrowing gap with a squawk of protest, leaps over my legs, and bolts downstairs. Clever puss. The revenant is between me and the wardrobe, and the bedroom door only locks on the inside, and I am so fucked that it isn't funny. Blink.
Mo, are you all right?
The next thing I am aware of is that I am lying on the upstairs landing carpet, staring at the light bulb swinging overhead at the end of its tether. Bob is lowering himself to crouch by my side, a look of deep concern on his face. I startle and try to slither sideways away from him, but I run into the wall before I can go anywhere, and then I realise that his eyes are perfectly normal. You... I raise my right hand and point at him.
Feeders!
What? He asks very intelligently. I'm beginning to wake up, and the questions cluttering up my head distract me so that I only notice after a few seconds that he's stroking my knee in what he evidently believes is a reassuring manner. I close my eyes and try not to cry. I'm not dying. The green glowing worms in the eyes are a sign of possession by the feeders in the night, which are contagious and lethal if you're not warded. Oddly, I don't wear a ward in bed with my husband. I am clearly losing the plot. I sniff, then sniff again, and begin to weep piteously. After a minute, I feel the comforting warmth of his arms around my shoulders.
"What scared you?"
he asks after a while.
"Can I get you anything?"
I just weep harder, from sheer frustration as much as anything else. Stupid lacrimatory reflex. What can I say? I thought you died in the night and were possessed by a feeder. I was going to stick this crowbar through your chest. None of it works. All of those sentences lead to broken futures. The cat! I finally manage through my sniffles.
Is she all right?
Is she... I don't know. Do you want me to go and look?
I try to nod.
Yes, she ran downstairs.
She saved my life. Or maybe yours. If she hadn't woken both of us in time. I sniff again and take a deep breath. We're both grown-ups, aren't we? Bob thinks, with some justification, that my violin is a danger to his life. Well, I'm sure we can find a way to work around that. But what if Bob is a danger to me? I think back to something he said last week. I have access to a lot of stuff. Angleton's stuff. Angleton was possessed by, or superpowered by, take your pick, an ancient and powerful alien intelligence from another universe. Bob was accidentally cross-linked to it a couple years ago, when a cult of murderous idiots tried to sacrifice him in order to invoke and incarnate the Eater of Souls. Now Angleton is dead. Bob is the only mortal vessel for the Eater of Souls to walk the earth, and one of the first skills Angleton taught him was the control and summoning of the lesser feeders. I take another deep breath that ends in a bubbly snuffle. I shuffle back against the wall and then push myself creakily to my feet. I stumble to the bathroom. I'm a sight fit to frighten babies. I blow my nose. Then, hands shaking, I pull out a couple of makeup remover pads. Sleeping in eyeliner and lipstick. Ick. The ritual of removal gives me time to calm down and centre myself, and I manage not to jump out of my skin when the floorboards outside the bathroom door creak under the weight of Bob's tread. I turn and look at my husband. He's standing there, completely naked except for the black furry comma, cradled in his arms. Spooky blinks at me dim-wittedly, then purrs, as Bob scritches along the edge of her jaw. Stupid self-centred animal. I straighten up and extend a tentative finger for the cat to sniff. All I can manage for Bob is my most fragile smile. One suitable for weddings, funerals, and being woken up in the middle of the night by demons. Thanks, I say. Thanks for what? He looks puzzled. Thanks for not being dead. I can't help myself. I nearly lose it again. When I come back to myself, he's not holding Spooky anymore, but he still looks puzzled. What happened? He asks. I take a deep breath. I'm not sure we can make this work. Oh, Mo. It's not just Lecter. Your eyes. Did you know they glow in the dark? Wait, what? You've become the fucking Eater of Souls. I cross my arms. Pardon my French. You... I can't stand this. A couple of seconds later, I'm shivering and weeping on his shoulder. He stands still holding me. He periodically tries to pat my shoulder, ineffectually offering reassurance. Are you undead? I ask anxiously between sobs. I don't think so, he says after a while. I don't feel as if I died. At least not recently. But your eyes did the glowing thing. If Spooky hadn't woken you up, do you really think I'd willingly harm a hair on your head? Not you. I'm shaking. It. The thing you carry around with you all the time now. Your new passenger. The irony of what I'm saying isn't lost on me. I don't know what it wants, but it frightens me. Another little white lie. I'm afraid that it is aware of Lecter and sees the violin and its bearer as a threat. I've been steering my own course for most of a decade, despite being burdened with a monstrous payload. I know how hard it can be to know your own mind, to separate your desire from the subtle blandishments of an insidious intruder. How hard is it going to be for Bob? He doesn't have my experience. I grab his waist and try to bury my chin in his shoulder. The shaking intensifies. I feel cold. I think.
I hear his voice as if it comes from far away.
We can still live together. If it's only sleeping that's the issue, we just need another bedroom, locks and wards on the doors.
I pull back for just long enough to punch his arm.
In London. Stupid. Might as well ask for a lottery win.
We live in a key worker's house we rent from the laundry at a price based on what it was worth 30 years ago. London's current overheated bubble market has been running for decades, and the average two-bedroom apartment, with cardboard walls, in a bad part of suburbia, costs around £500,000.
We're civil servants. While we're not badly paid, we'd need £100,000 in cash just to put down a deposit. We don't have that kind of money.
If only a life of crime was an option.
I'd have gotten away with it too, if it wasn't for your meddling kids.
He chuckles sadly.
Go back to bed, Mo. Lock the bedroom door. I'll grab the spare duvet and use the living room sofa. But tomorrow I've got to go down to Dunwich. We can talk about it while I'm gone, can't we? We'll figure something out.
Yes, we will, I reply. But I'm increasingly scared that we won't.